History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Captivity required from us. Where governments lie, God does not lie. Where governments change, God does not change. And I'm through now. But let me leave you with one more thing. Governments fail. The government in this text, comprised of Caesar, Quirinius, Pontius Pilate, Pontius Pilate, the Roman government failed. The British government used to rule from east to west. The British government had a Union Jack. She colonized Kenya, Ghana, Nigeria, Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, and Hong Kong. Her navies ruled the seven seas all the way down to the tip of Argentina in the Falklands. But the British government failed. The Russian government failed. The Japanese government failed. The German government failed. And the United States of America government, when it came to treating her citizens of Indian descent fairly, she failed. She put them on reservations. When it came to treating her citizens of Japanese descent fairly, she failed. She put them in internment prison camps. When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
Hotep, and good afternoon, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. My name is Dr. William Rogers, and I am your host for this evening. As you know, we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Here on the TimeForAnAwakening.com radio network, which is also a part of the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. The number one podcast system in America. It has been rated the number one black podcast system in America. And I'm so proud to be a part of that and what we are doing here and what we are trying to do and the word that we're passing forward through our programming. We have a very dynamic and powerful discussion for you today. It's titled Racism and Religion. An American Dilemma. Racism and Religion. An American Dilemma. And this is sort of the maiden voyage of our discussion that we're going to be having over the next few weeks as it relates to the Black Church and spirituality in African-American life. As you know, that is a very, very important part of our existence. Who we are as a people, that is how we have survived in this wilderness, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, in this wilderness called North America. We have survived because of our spirituality, whatever it may have been. So I want to talk over the next few weeks about the Black Church. There are some things that myself, as an elder in the community, and as a historian, and one that has taught religious studies in reference to the Black Church, I'm disturbed that there is such a disgruntled nature and feeling about the Black Church in America. And I'm not saying it's not justified. I'm not trying to defend it right away. I want to be honest about it. And so over the next few weeks, we're going to talk about it. We're going to have some ministers who are going to come forward, people of the clergy, people of the lay field, agnostics, atheists, whatever they may be. We're going to have some who embrace various religious groups And we're going to talk about that experience and the and African people. It's not just a discussion about Christianity or Islam. It's just a general spirituality concept. And so today is our kickoff to that because we want to get down at the root of what it is. So we're looking today at race, at racism and religion, an American dilemma. And so very clearly we are excited about that, and we have one of my good buddies, my brother, who was always very supportive of the Black Reality Think Tank. He's going to be coming forward, and he's going to work with me and help me do that discussion. And we have other members of our audience who are also very, very supportive, and they're going to be coming forward as well. So, in the words of the great Marcus Mosiah Garvey, one race, one aim, one destiny. Up, you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. And so that is the platform in which we ride on. That is the platform in which we present and stand as we talk about liberation. As I said before, the Time for an Awakening network system is very important and very powerful entity and tool for our community. So I hope that you will pass the word on and tell your friends and others to tune in to www.timeforanawakening.com. And not only for just this program, the Black Reality Think Tank, but we've got some other wonderful programs as well. And you can tune in to those. Our program is sponsored by the Motherland Media Network, which is also a wonderful platform as well. It produces two other programs other than the Black Reality Think Tank. One is African Perspectives, and that is by the executive director for Motherland Media, Brother Oshiemi Adelabu. And also the Black People Matrix, which is also a part of the Motherland Media with Brother Franklin Jones, is also on that network as well. And so I want to talk a little bit later. I'm going to wait, and I'm going to come back and go over the lineup of programs that are on this so that you can tune in. We also archive everything that we do. The archive is a system that you can go in 24/7 and listen to any of our broadcasts. You simply go into the website, www.timeforanawakening.com. All one word, small letters, and all of our programs. And then what you can do is pull down the column that says podcast, and then you can look for the various networks that are on there, various programs, and we are listed there, and most of our programs are there. There are some that we're still going to be adding to that list, and this program tonight we're going to do as well. And so you can go back, tell other folk to listen who may not have heard tonight. You can tell them to go in and listen as well. And so we're really just appreciative of this system. And here in the Black Reality Think Tank, it is a part of the Sankofa Historical Society. We have a group of folks that work with us in that. We have a group of young students out of Howard University that help me tremendously in finding material. I have them consistently digging into that Spingarn archive and getting me some of that unknown information that you can't find anywhere else. And so I use their ability to do that. We're also looking forward. We are planning to add a co-host to our program that will be coming on periodically. It won't necessarily come on each week, but periodically as them. She sees fit. She's a very busy activist. It's a woman. Gives that male-female perspective on things. So Sister Bonisawa Ayan is going to be joining me as a co-host in the weeks coming up. As a matter of fact, one of the programs that she probably will join and be a part of is the one on the Black Church. So we're looking forward to that discussion as well. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, again for your support. Thank you for being with us each and every week. We have really began to develop a wonderful audience of listeners, and we're so appreciative of you and those of you that have been emailing me and, you know, saying things and making comments. I appreciate that. I need that. I need that energy. That's a boost. So sometimes when you're tired, you say, oh, I don't feel like doing this today. But then when I think about you and I think about others who I know have been consistently supporting our work, I'm energized to continue to move on. Each week, I like to do what we call the ancestral profile. An ancestral profile is one that we honor those that have gone before us. And that is a very sacred process in the African life. And so we want to follow the words of the great Fannie Lou Hamer, the activist sharecropper from Mississippi. And I always remember her words when it says, we must always praise the bridges that brought us over. And so each week we do that. And so this week we are going to be discussing a brother. Some of you may know of him, some of you may not. But he's a very interesting individual in history. And hopefully you can go back in if you have an interest in him and look at some of the work he's done. He's not as quite as popular as, say, maybe the Honorable Garvey or as a Du Bois or somebody like that. But he does serve a very powerful purpose in the African experience. His name is Marcelino Manuel de Guaca. Marcelino Manuel de Guaca, better known as Charles Manuel Sweet Daddy Grace. Charles Manuel Sweet Daddy Grace. He was the founder and the first bishop of the predominantly African-American denomination called the United House of Prayer for All People. He was a contemporary of other religious leaders such as Father Divine, Noble Drew Ali, Ernest Holmes, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and others. Daddy Grace was an innovative Christian evangelist, faith healer, pastor, and bishop. He used his unique worship style to birth a distinctive religious institution on the American scene. Many of the followers claimed miraculous acts of faith healing while attending services, and others that saw his ministry as a sign from God of the imminent return of Jesus Christ. Marcelino Manuel de Guaca's parents were Manuel, born 1837, passed in 1926, and Gertrude de Guaca, born 1847, died in 1933. Marcelino de Guaca had a brother and sister, which consisted of one brother, Ben Ventura, and four sisters, Eugenia, Sylvia, Amelia, and Louise. He was born January 25th in Brava in the Cape Verde Islands, which was then a Portuguese possession off of the west coast of Africa. And that is for those Hispanic natives. That's why he has a Spanish name, because as you know, the Portuguese go into Africa, or any of those European go into Africa, one of the first things they do is rape the women. And so you cross the bloodline. And so obviously he is a victim of that. There is no, however, verifiable information to confirm Sweet Daddy Grace's exact birth year, but most sources either state 1881 or 1884. The family of Manuel de Guaca, the father, Marcelino, arrived in America in the port of New Bedford, Massachusetts, aboard a ship called the Freeman in May of 1902. It is unclear whether Marcelino was aboard that ship at the time, but the ship manifest does show that he visited America in 1903, and in 1904, he came as a cabin passenger aboard the schooner called the Louisa. And by the way, Sweet Daddy Grace was born January 25th, 1881, supposedly, or 84, and he transitioned on January 12th, 1860. Marcelino Grace married twice. His first wife was Jane Jenny Lumbar, who was also a Cape Verdean woman, also known as Jenny Lombard. They were married in 1909. She bore Sweet Daddy Grace a daughter, Irene, in 1910, and a son, Norman, in 1912. Norman died in 1947. Whether they officially divorced was disputed. His second wife was Angelina Montano Grace, of Mexican descent, whom he married in 1932. She bore him a son, Marcelino, in 1935. They divorced, however, in 1937. They divorced in 1937. Sorry about that. In the book, Daddy Grace, which was written by Marie Dallum, and you might want to get a copy of that. I think it's still available. It gives a very interesting, detailed story of his life. It's called Daddy Grace. Her name is Marie Dallum, D-A-L-L-A-M. She notes that the entire DeGraca family were Roman Catholic in their homeland, and they opened up to different forms of Christian experience, you know, once they immigrated to the United States. There was a Protestant group called the Church of the Nazarene. That was the first non-Catholic Christian church to establish a mission in the Cape Verde Islands in 1900. Benventura de Graca, who was the brother of Sweet Daddy Grace, would later become a Church of the Nazarene pastor in the U.S. Marcelino, however, was said inside the de Graca family, according to the research that was done, to have always been a special child. Unlike the conventional ministry of his brother, he went on to establish a unique and the independent Christian ministry. Sweet Daddy Grace, after becoming a famous bishop, he was recounted that as a youth he had received a commission to preach directly from God. The United House of Prayer was the name of his organization. After leaving his job as a railroad cook, Sweet Daddy Grace, using the anglicized version of his name, Charles Manuel, and he called himself Emmanuel Grace, began using the title Bishop. And in 1919, he built the first house of prayer in West Wareham, Massachusetts, at the cost of $39. He later established branches of the church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Newark, New Jersey. Throughout the 1920s and 30s, Bishop Grace traveled America, preaching and establishing the United House of Prayer of all people. The Constitution and the bylaws of the United House of Prayer, promulgated in 1929, stated that the purpose of the organization, in pertinent part, was to erect and maintain places of worship and assembly where all people may gather in prayer and to worship the Almighty God, irrespective of denomination or creed. He traveled extensively throughout the segregated South in the 1920s and the 1930s, preaching to integrated congregations years before the civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 1960s, and the religious ecumenical movements which followed. Bishop Grace died in 1960, and he is buried in the Pine Grove Cemetery in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I had an opportunity to know some individuals that were a part of the United House of Prayer for All People. I remember during my years of living in New York City, I lived in Harlem when I first went to New York. I lived on 120th Street between 8th and Manhattan Avenue. And I used to go up to
a... in Birmingham.
I'm sorry, folks. I had somebody came on. And I had an opportunity to go to the House of Prayer. And I'm telling you, that music was the most powerful thing that happened. And I was a young man at the time, 19. And they used to, the church in Harlem was located right over a record store called Unity Records. And it was right across the street from the Apollo Theater. And I tell you, more people would be over there across the street. Well, actually, they were dancing to the music that was coming out of the House of Prayer. They had drums, guitar, tambourines, and so forth, and they were playing the gospel music. And all of our brothers and sisters who were indulging in the drug business, they would be over there weaving and dodging, listening to the music coming out of Daddy Grace's church. Now, he left a major legacy. We have people like Reverend Ike, who came behind, and some others. Now, Bishop McCullough, or at least it was at one time the bishop of the Church of House and Prayer. I'm not sure who it is now. But the reason that this is vital is that there is a misunderstanding about those black preachers of that time frame who lived in the era of, as I said, Noble Drew Ali, Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Father Divine, Sweet Daddy Grace, and their work was about helping our people. Some of the best food in America came out of the United House of Prayer. I remember having a friend that I used to go visit all the time in Washington, D.C., and they had a big church sitting over off of Georgia Avenue. And we used to go over there on Friday, and that fish was so good. And they fed lots of people. Father Divine fed people. And so even the mysticism that maybe have followed them, that mysticism was a part of the growth and the healing of our community. So we have to be careful as we knock things like that, because it may appear that these are just jackleg people that are just trying to rip folk off for money. No, that's not the case. And there's a long history, well detailed, well documented, that talks clearly about the work that they did. And so that form of spirituality, even though it may have been strange out of the traditional religious focus, but it was extremely powerful. And we see the energy of that, even in things like The Nation, how very powerful The Nation of Islam works, how they feed people. They got farms, restaurants, schools, centers. The same thing with the House of Prayer. They had schools, farms, grocery stores, and they were feeding communities. Father Divine, feeding communities. I don't know how many of you saw the movie with Larry Fishburne. He played the gangster, a movie of a gangster, and that's the one that Vanessa Williams was in there, and he was looking at Vanessa Williams. He was, you know, dating her. And when he first met her, Vanessa Williams was on the back of a truck passing out food. Well, that truck belonged to Father Divine. And whatever the history behind that, it was powerful. I know a very dear brother out of North Carolina, a pastor. He was not only a pastor, but a psychologist. His daughter's a very good friend. Dr. Grady Davis wrote his doctoral dissertation on Father Divine. And he was able to carry some things. So anyway, that's what I wanted to do, why I wanted to do Father Sweet Daddy Grace, because we're going to talk about what the black church did in those times. It's changed a little bit now. It's not the same, but those were powerful ministries that fed people, that clothed people, that housed people, food, clothing, and shelter. They did that. And they did it with no cost. And there are only a few, like The Nation, still around. The House of Prayer is still around. Father Divine's ministries and obviously are gone. But they were powerful entities. Okay, real quickly, I want to just mention some of the programs that are on the Time for Awakening Network. Brother Oshi Adelabu's program, African Perspectives, comes on every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. African Perspectives, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Simply go into www.timeforanawakening.com. It's streaming live beginning at 11, or you can call 215-490-9832 and listen via phone. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And then on Monday and Wednesday, right after African Perspectives, from 1 to 3, is Brother Franklin Jones. He has a program called The Black People Matrix. He was one of our guests on our program last week. I really appreciate his input and the work that he does. Very powerful Facebook presence, internet presence he has, with a wonderful site, a lot of good information. Again, Brother Franklin Jones, Monday, Wednesday from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, timeforanawakening.com. Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds. Acres of Diamonds, Monday evening, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., all Eastern Time. Let's Buy Black, 365, Monday evenings, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Let's Buy Black, 365. Powerful economic process and program. And then, as you know, on Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. And then on Wednesday, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Proof of Consciousness with host Proof of Consciousness. And the name of the program is Revive. Revive, hosted by Proof of Consciousness every Wednesday evening from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. And then Relationships with Joy and Troy on Thursday evenings from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Relationships with Joy and Troy, Thursday evenings from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then on Friday, Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. Program beginning at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Powerful, dynamic conversations, wonderful guests. I had the honor of going on last Friday and talk about the Reconstruction period of history. And I had a wonderful dialogue with Brother Richard and Brother Elliot. And you can go to our archive, and that is available for you to listen. And then on Sunday, the same thing, Time for an Awakening. It airs at that time from 7 to 10. Time for an Awakening from 7 to 10 on Sunday, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And also then on Saturday, I want to just mention there's a program called Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore. And so that is our lineup here on Time for an Awakening. I understand that there are other things that are coming aboard that you will be able to look forward to. But by all means, you can go, as I said, to the archive, www.timeforanawakening.com, and pull up any of the programs to listen to. Our program here and our program tonight is a call-in format, 215-490-9832. You simply call and from the switchboard, and I will see you. And I can, if you like to say something, that's fine. If it's not just to listen, that's fine too. But we welcome you. And be sure, as I said before, pass the word on to others about the Time for an Awakening system. And I think it will empower our community, as I know that it can. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are ready to begin our conversation. Racism and religion. Racism and religion. An American dilemma. Racism and religion. An American dilemma. A lot of things are out there. A question, I guess, some might ask, what is the value of talking about a thing like that? Where you plan to get out of that? What do you want to get out of it? Well, I said, first of all, it's a prologue to the upcoming discussion that we're going to do on the Black Church. But African people are very powerful spiritual people. That's who we are. That's how we survived the transatlantic slave trade. That's how we survived the Middle Passage. That's how we survived the plantations of the South. That's how we survived the cotton fields of tenant farming, sharecropping, and all of that. That's how we survived the Jim Crow racism of the 40s and the 50s. That's how we survived the threats and the terrorism of the civil rights years. That's how we can survive the crack generation and those that are bringing in death to our community. Those are the ways that we do that. And it obviously varies. There is no one way. There are many systems that we use. But I think we as a people and our children need to understand and know how they work. And as a result of that, find ways to support it, find ways to use it. Historically, the church has been at the center of pushing forward our liberation. It is at the center. There is no there's no way that you can say that it has not done that. All of the evidence. There are people still living who were part of all of that. I was raised in a church, in a community in the Carolinas that was a clear center of manhood and sisterhood development. And as a result of that, we were able to move forward. And I'm able to sit here today with you and talk to our audience about the idea of liberation, because it was given to me back then using a format of the spirituality system. So that's why we wanted to talk about it, number one, because it's so vital and so important. But however, it has been used in many ways in a very destructive way. It has been used sometimes by others to actually strike fear and terror in our hearts. And in the promotional item that I had put out advertising the coming of this program, I put a picture of the church in South Carolina with Dylann Roof as he walked up in that church and shot those people and killed those people with a cold and callous heart. How much hatred can a person have? What kind of people have done to you to create that kind of hate? What is it in the system of American life that would generate those kind of people? Why do you have a people like that? Where do they come from? Where did they get those ideas from? Who said that? Who told them they were better than anybody else? Where did that come from? And that's what we'll talk about tonight. And we've been talking about it previously on a couple of other programs, but we're going to focus in on it based on the whole religious idea. And I asked my brother, Brother James Pugh, to come on. And as I said, there are some others here online with me that are going to talk about some of that. And mainly what I want to do is first of all, give all of you some resources that talk about where this mess comes from. Who said that? Why did they say that? You know, those are real questions, because we encounter those very same people today. They are still out there who feel, and the Dylann Roofs didn't go anywhere. They're still there. There's a Dylann Roof waiting to strike any day. And we have to be prepared. We're not going to be able to sit back and just let somebody walk up in their church and sit next to us and you don't question who he is as a stranger. You can't do that anymore. Because I often raise the question, is why those people didn't question him? You know, what happened? Well, you know, they're loving, a brotherhood thing. They figure there's a white brother coming out of the community from Charleston that might want to worship with them. You can't do that anymore. That's not in the age of this, what we're living in, that's not possible. And so I want to talk about the history of that first. There are several sources that have attempted to address that. There's one that I have been in a constant discussion with that I have talked about several times on this program, and that's the book by Brother Ibram X. Kendi. Brother Kendi wrote a book called The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. And then there's a book a little bit older than that one called White Over Black, American Attitudes Toward the Negro, from 1560 to 1812. That book was written by Winthrop Jordan. And then there's a book that was a follow-up in the 60s to White Over Black by a white psychiatrist whose name was Joel Covell. Covell wrote a book called White Racism, A Psychohistory. And then there was an ancestor, one of our ancestors, Dr. Early Thorpe, wrote a book called The Old South, A Psychohistory. And in that, he addresses some of the sentiments of the old plantation South and who they were and what they felt and where they came from. And then there are other books that are around that also could do that. But again, the layperson, you know, being able to sit down and pull all that together, that's where we depend on our community of historians and scholars and strong people of history to refer that to us. And that's what this program attempts to do. That's what African Perspectives attempts to do. That's what Time for an Awakening attempts to do, and the Black People Matrix. We attempt to sort of help our community a little bit by going and researching and bringing people on the program who can talk about it. And so that way, if you have questions, you can call us, ask us, well, what about this? Where you get that from? Who said that? You know, and we can provide you with a roadmap into understanding. And then always asking the question, why is this important? What do I need? How is it going to help me right now in 2019? You need to ask that question because there is something that it will do. And we want to be able to address that. I want to start, and then I'm going to bring on my brother, James Pugh. I want to start, first of all, by looking at the ancient history. I've always said that understanding the racial makeup of the world and where it became such a noted factor, where it is obviously used in the economic and the political realm of things, begins very early. It began during the onset of the Greek Empire. The Greek was partially Aryan, what we call the Aryan Indo-race environment, even though a lot of the Greeks were Africans in many cases. But that's where a lot of the divisional history begins. So when you start looking at people like Alexander and the rise of the Greek Empire and then eventually the Roman Empire, which was coming, was a part of a culture called Etruscans. And the Etruscans were very clearly coming out of that realm of the Mediterranean. And one of the things that people like Dr. Francis Crest Wilson and John Henry Clark and others say, these were folk coming out of those Caucasoid mountains of Europe, who had been forced to go up into the caves because of the cold weather and the bad distances. And so a lot of the history begins with that and their ideology of things and them losing their ability to produce pigmentation and obviously creating what was then becoming a clear distinction in terms of race. And, I mean, we are visceral people. The empirical life is real. You can't rule that out. There's an issue about seeing people, and that's what we are looking at. But some of the early writings of that began back in those days of the biblical power, and then it began to trickle down into the Greek Empire. Plato, as well as Aristotle, were very strong racists. Their views and ideas were beginning of some ugly thought. Aristotle wrote a book, and he spoke of the fact that the Mediterranean was a division between people who were pigmented, and he said, based on the weather. And he said that the climate had a lot to do with the nature of the people. People in colder regions and regions were cooler were a bit more advanced. They were more articulate because the heat would prevent them from being able to be, you know, as astute as they were. But the people below the Mediterranean, where the weather was hot, were backwards. They were ignorant. They didn't wear clothes. They ate different kinds of food, and as a result of that, they would not be prepared to be civilizers of the world. And this theory Plato wrote about becomes a textbook for another generation of those that are being raised and looking at that material. The other way, other purpose, is the explorers who were beginning to circumvent the world and they were coming back with what they were seeing. They were seeing color differently. If you read the diaries of a lot of those explorers, some of the things that they were writing about what they saw, and they were just basically writing it on their influx. They had no solid theory of where it came from. It's just straight out scientific racism based on what they saw. And some of them were writing that they saw gorillas in the waters of Africa fishing. And that they saw people that were very ugly and monster-like, and they were afraid to go on shore, so they kept going down the coastline. Some of them did, and then some said, well, we went on the coastline because we wanted to see who they were. And And as a result, they weren't like us. They weren't intelligent, but, you know, they did seem to be human-like. And so these stories were written in their diaries, which come back to Europe and become the geography books of the European world, because that is the only source that they have. And you must remember that the European universities started very early. They started in the 1700s, 1600s. Harvard and Cambridge was started around the 1600s. Yale, 1700s. William and Mary, which was one of the first colleges in America to begin. And all of these schools were religious. All of them were based on religion. And there was something in the Bible that confused hermeneutically the biblical world of Europe. They did not understand it. And as a result, they used it to differentiate the races of people. And that was the theory around Noah and the curse of Ham. And as Winthrop Jordan said, he said, every denomination, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Congregational, Baptist, Pentecostal, all of them had the same analogy about who Ham was, that Noah's children were the divisions of the races of the world, and that Ham had been cursed to blackness by Noah. And one of the first books to put that in writing was the Babylonian Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud said that Noah cursed his son Ham to blackness. And the Talmud at that point became the rabbinical power to use to teach the what was known at that time as the Pentateuch, the five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, Numbers and Deuteronomy. So that is the beginning of the biblical part of that. And the key to it, the key to understanding that is that with that written like that in the Babylonian Talmud, it would then follow itself around to other religions as well. Now, if you look at the Bible today, after the King James adaptation of it and change, and even previously to that, you will see that it was, what was taken out is they took out that Noah cursed him to blackness. It says Noah cursed him to servitude, that he was to serve. And so that language was changed. But it's the same thing. Who else were the servants of the world except those that were being brought in, the Africans, the Native Americans, and those cultures that were being forced to work? And so there you have the beginning of the religious roots of racism. And at that point, all of the adaptation, the power, and the biblical works, with it, and then you couple that with the documents from those explorers, and talking about what those what they considered to be primitive worlds and what they looked at, and it was not just only Africa per se, but it was other areas of the world as well. That felt that it gave them the right to capture, conquer, and to rule over these smaller empires. That ugly history is the start of what we see. And since from there, they'll begin to interpret other books and other writings that would support a lot of those kinds of things. And then we get into this whole thing about Arianism. Arianism, believe it, is supposed to come out of Iran. It is part of an Iranian system. And a lot of the folk of that era say that that has nothing to do with white supremacy and white bloodline. But somehow the Europeans still took it, and they still made it a part of creating whiteness and creating pureness. And as a result of that, that begins to fester itself. And so as the Americas, as the conquerors are going throughout the world now, from Europe, as they're going to conquer whatever they can find, they're bringing this ideology with them. And in order for the people that they conquer to live and be a part and survive, they must embrace this theory and this idea. The biggest conflict of that is going to happen coming out of Morocco. Morocco is, there's going to be an influx of people who are going to go into Europe, beginning with Portugal and Spain. These folk were called the Moors, and the Moors were, as Shakespeare said, they were tawny. They were of a strange color, and he said they were, but they were civilized, and they would go into Portugal and Spain and redirect the whole civilization. They would show the people of that area who were basically living in a Barbary lifestyle, they would show them things like sanitation. They would show them how to dispose of their waste. They would show them how to cook food and build temples, and how those temples would reflect their spirits. They would show them the art of animal husbandry, how to take care of a camel. You had to know how to take care of a camel, and those camels would become the tractor trailers of that region, and they would go in there and bring life to that. One of the biggest problems is that obviously anytime that happens, the bloodlines cross. And so what we would begin to find is the interaction of the Moors with a lot of the Indos. The actual settlement of the Portuguese and the Spanish comes from the German tribe called the Vandals. The Vandals are the ones that will settle that region. And just like everybody else in the world, there were tribes of Europeans. There was the Vandals, there was the Goths, they had the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, they had the Vikings, they had the Normans, the Franks, and all of them who would settle various parts of Europe, coming out of the what John Henry Clark said was the icebox of the Caucasoid Mountains. And they would settle along the Mediterranean looking for warmth. So by the time that we began to develop the modern world, the German tribes will be the ones that will have settled all along there. And that's who is the ones that will be preventing some of the ideas. And there are lots of books that talk about all of this history. And I don't have time, obviously, tonight to sit here and go through all of it because I want to talk about some things that Brother Pugh has done. But this is just a start of the root of this racist ideology that was embedded into Christian and other religious thought. And Christianity was not the only one infiltrated with this garbage. Some forms of Islam were done that. The Arabs, and whoever the Arabs are, and how you look at that, there's a book by a guy named John Hitti, H-I-T-T-E, called The History of the Arabs, and talks about where they come from, who they are. And a lot of that is your Indo-Urine bloodline. Those Arabs out of Saudi Arabia and even Iran, a lot of that has to do with Zoroastrianism, which is a part of the Persian religion in Persia. But Zoroastrianism is an early form of Christianity. And one of the things that the Zoroastrians did, they did the religious thing too. They did that color piece. Zoroastrianism says that darkness was evil and that darkness was a sign of the devil. And that if you're going to be liberated and smart, you have to have light. And there has to be light. And if you were to look at Zoroastrianism and its principles, you would see that. Zoroastrianism very clearly preaches that. And that comes out of Persia. And it is from that Zoroastrianism that it begins to spread along the European. And then the Crusades. The Crusades would obviously do some things as well. And there are people who understood that all of Europe didn't embrace that. It's a guy named Martin Bernal, who's a historian, who talked about that. Basil Davidson talks about that influence and some of the other things. And then there were people like Shakespeare who attempted to stab at it. And in his writings, he was able to influence the English, which was that Anglo group. And that, at that time, they were strictly the Anglos, and then there was the Saxons, then there was the Normans, and all of that. And then eventually they came together under the banner of the Anglo-Saxon race. But Shakespeare wrote a lot about blackness, and he wrote negative things about blackness. Othello is a tragic figure. And what he was doing was attempting to diminish the Moorish lifestyle. And he attempted to go in. And as a result, the Queen of England read it, and she then began to look at the Moors different. And as a result of that readings, they began to imprison a lot of the Moors. But the Moors kept fighting, and they were wreaking havoc along that coast. And then the Arabs came in. And then the Huns came in, and then the Mongols came into Europe. And all of Europe was at war. So Europe would develop itself as a war nation. It had to, or be eliminated. And when we talk about Europe, we're talking about the Germans. It is the Germans that would have to war the Mongols, the Huns, and all of them coming over the Himalaya Mountains would come into Europe and wage war. And as a result, that's where we began to see the development of the Turkish Empire, the Constantinople, and all of those which had a tinted complexion because of the fact that their influence of who they were and what they were doing. So anyway, it's a long, tedious history to read and study about, but at least it gives us a working understanding of where racism intermerges with religion. And then, as you know, we moved to the modern era. It was used vehemently to suppress and terrorize our people. Slavery was justified based on religion. It was, and I don't care what anybody says, it was the Catholic Church that started slavery in the Americas. It was the Catholic Church that started slavery in America. It was the government of Europe. Catholicism was the government of Europe until the Crusades in the 1600s would come in and create the Protestantism system. But even then, they had to run, because when Henry VIII decided that he didn't want to pay attention to the church anymore, he really began to kick them out and behead them and do all those kinds of things. And he started his own religion called the Church of England, and that was the Anglican Church. And that church still exists today, but that was the church of Henry VIII, and they would take on a whole nother image and begin to create something. One last point, and then I'm going to bring Brother Pugh on. There was a concept, and again, it requires some in-depth study as a philosophical principle. It's called imago D-I, I-M-A-G-O-D-E-I, two words, imago D-I. And what it means, this means the image of God. And so to reinforce that whiteness was purity and that any other color outside of whiteness was evil, this theory began to permeate throughout Europe. And the people that would promote it and practice it would be the artists and the painters. And one of the first people to support the imago dei theory was Michelangelo. Michelangelo would begin to create artwork that reflected the whiteness of all of the biblical people. David, and the picture of just slipped my mind. He was laying down and reaching out his hand, and he was in a garden, and he painted that one as well to show whiteness. And then the ultimate picture would be at the Chapel of the Sistine Madonna And that was the one where Jesus, where God reached his hand, finger down, and touched the head of man to bless him. And that finger was a white finger. And as a result of that, God had to be white. And so the religion and the practice of that, imago Dei, is another way that this religion was permeated. So God is white, Jesus is white, David was white, Mary was white, and all of those were white. And as a result of that, that is bad. So if you worship this, you're worshiping the white man religion, according to them, obviously. I think that gives us the groundwork in which to start on it. I asked Mr. Pugh to look at a book that he had actually introduced to me on a couple of programs back about also this history. And he begins, and this particular book goes in and looks at the philosophers of Europe and what they were saying. And again, we're doing this because this is the groundwork for who we are and what being done here in America. This is a part of the legislation of America. You got to remember, right now you think that there's this theory going on between that there's a separation between church and state. Forget that. That's not the case. There's no separation between church and state. It's the same thing, because at one point the state was the church, and they did rule. So a lot of the laws, the penal laws and codes that are in the law books today in America come from religious systems. The 13 colonies, except for Georgia, were settled by religious people. It was based on Puritanism, Protestantism, Catholics, all set those 13 colonies in motion. And their ideas and their rules and regulations and in their charters are principles of religion. Even the money says, "In God we trust." Everywhere is religion and politics. They have not separated themselves. And clearly they may have separated on paper, but definitely not in ideology. They are the same thing. And so I asked him to take a look at some books that talk about that. I also asked him to take a look at a new piece of literature that's out that's going to be very interesting, and that is dealing with rich care and racism. Racism, basically, is a major part of witchcraft, and we're going to talk about that a little bit in just a moment. So with that, good afternoon, Brother Pugh. Thank you so much for being with us here, and I want you to come on and talk a little bit about what we said. So good afternoon, Brother Pugh. How you doing?
Well, good evening, Doctor.
Good. Great, great, great. So why don't you just launch on out into what we want to do here?
Well, I don't know. I'll give you a choice. You know, you were talking about Daddy Grace and spirituality and whatnot. Uh-huh. And it turns out that there's a way that can be talked about that ties everything together, I think, in the most relevant bow possible.
Right. I agree.
So if you like, I'll take a stab at that.
Okay, please.
You know,
go right ahead.
Well, you know, it turns out that spirituality, it turns out that human beings have problems. And there are four tools that they use to solve their problems. One tool that humans use is called acceptance, meaning that whatever problem you have in your world, within your reach, is something that, you know, will solve your problem for you. And it's just a matter of you finding it. That's what hunting is all about. The second kind of solution to problems that human beings have is called understanding. And that means that you found the thing that will solve your problem, but you don't know how to use it. And so you need to understand it. So that's the second solution. Mm-hmm. The third kind of solution that humans have to solve their problem is called transformation. And this is the spiritual solution. And this is the best way of thinking about this is that you imagine something. You know, in fact, the way that they say it, canonically, is that in the beginning was the Word. And so you begin with a word. You begin to think the thoughts associated with that word. You take the actions associated with those thoughts, and that manifests in the thing, in reality, right? That's right. The third way. That's the spiritual way, and that's what we're going to elaborate on in a second. And then there's a fourth way that human beings solve problems, and that's the creative way. And we would call that manufacturing. And that's where you begin with a design in your mind.
Right.
You know, you'd like to make a suit. And so then you imagine some pattern for a suit, and you go out in the world and you get some fabric, and you come and you sew that fabric together, and then you see if that suit meets your specifications. Well, so those are the four ways you can solve problems. The spiritual way, the way of transformation, the in the beginning was the word way, that's what you see Daddy Grace doing. And one of the things that you can understand about Dylann Roof is that, you know, whenever people, you know, military theorists, they always, one of the fundamental critiques of other generals is that, hey, man, you fight in the last war. That is to say, you assume that your enemy is going to do in this next war what they did in the last war, and so that, so you're attacking that. That's what Dylann Roof was doing, mm-hmm. That the black community used spirituality to essentially transform America. And so if you're a white supremacist and you're interested in defeating black people and you're fighting the last war, then what you want to do is you want to defeat what you think is our winning hand, which is our source of spirituality. And as a result, a Dylann Roof will go and attack. Mother Emanuel was the oldest black church in America,
right?
So that was like, if the black church was a source of black strength, then Mother Emanuel would be the root of that strength. And if you annihilate people there and make people afraid of being there, then you've essentially eliminated one of the sources of strategic power that black people have. But the reason that Dylann Roof was fighting the last war is that, as you kind of intimated, church don't mean the same thing in 2019 that it meant in 1910 with Daddy Grace or with C.H. Mason and them and whatnot. In other words, church is not a strategy that's used to uplift a people. The message that you have in the black church today is called prosperity gospel.
Right.
And in that kind of message, you can have black people in absolute misery while the preacher is needing a $60 million jet.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dylann Roof, he thought that he was attacking the root of black strength. But in 2019, the church is not the root of black strength. And by the way, and so you can see it, and this relates, you know, one of the things that we're going to talk about is racism. And two of the authors that, you know, will come up, one of the people you just mentioned, Ibrahim Kendi, where he says that, you know, ultimately what people believe is a function of what they believe it's useful for them to believe. So if you have a use for an inferior people, you'll create that people. That's what Carter G. Woodson was saying, that if I can convince you that you're a slave, I don't need to tell you to go in the back door. You'll make a back door because that's the only way you'll be comfortable.
Right.
I'm kind of losing my thought where I was going with that. So one of the things that differentiates the church of Daddy Grace with the church today is that they both claim they're using spirituality,
mm-hmm.
but Daddy Grace's church was using spirituality. It was beginning with the word,
mm-hmm.
whereas the church today, I'm thinking right now of, say, Creflo Dollar, for example, down there in Atlanta.
Yep.
He's not using spirituality. He's using the way of creation, meaning that, in other words, everything that Daddy Grace did began in his heart, and it ended, the measure of whether or not it was a good thing or a bad thing was in the results, the manifestations in his community. On the other hand, the things that Creflo Dollar is doing, don't begin in his heart. They begin in his mind. They begin with an understanding that was given to him from somebody else's heart. He was told by white people what things are desirable to aspire to and so on. Mm-hmm. And he's simply implementing that. And so the very engine, the very thing that enables spirituality to work, which is in the beginning was the word, that is something in your heart. You don't get that in the black church today. And therefore, what that means is that they're not going to have that reservoir. In other words, when push comes to shove, if you're not starting from your heart, you ain't going to have no reservoir to turn to.
Right.
If all you're doing is starting from your mind, then as soon as somebody outmaneuvers whatever that mental technique is you had, you ain't got nothing else to go for. And so I would say Dylann Roof, he really misunderstands.
And that's exactly right.
And
even among the theologians, African theologians, they agree with you. They agree. James Cone, that's clearly his message before his transition. It's what you just said, you know. And I'm going to play a clip from James Cone in just a minute that will support everything that you just said, and that's good.
Oh, sure. And in fact, one of the things James Cone said in that connection is, you know, he talked about in the cross and the lynching tree. He asked the question,
right.
Well, where was Jesus while we were getting lynched, right?
Right.
And then he says that, well, you know, well, really, and so he's really talking about this, but he says that you can internalize external circumstances, but Jesus is what enables you not to do that. In other words, it enables you to retain some sense of yourself despite external circumstances. That's why people say I'm in the world but not of the world, that kind of thing. But go ahead, you've got a clip
exactly.
If you want to do.
Exactly. Let me take just a minute for our listeners, and I want you to hear something real quickly. I won't play all of it. But very clearly, what Mr. Pugh just said is what Dr. James, this was an interview with Travis Smiler some time back, but let's hear what he's saying.
I promise you this in just a moment. Before I jump to that, though, I want to get James Cone and the others who've not spoken involved in this conversation. James Cone, you're one of the brilliant minds in this country, certainly on the issue of theology and faith and the black church. Let me just ask you whether or not you believe that fundamentally the black church has in fact become too political. Is the black church too political? Has the church gotten away from its primary mission?
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here just like everybody else. And I'm also pleased that you asked me a question about whether the black church is too political. Of course, it all depends on what you mean by politics and in what way you mean that. I think one of the things that the black church needs to ask itself is what is its mission? What is its mission? I think one of the things that the black church has lost is a good understanding of its mission. Black church is good at preaching, good at singing, good at a lot of things, but the black church has not been as good as thinking about what its nature is and thinking about what its mission is. Is its mission primarily saving souls? Or is it saving bodies? Or is it both together? I think if you see them both together, I think you would have to see that the black church have to be political because politics is a part of life. It also has to be concerned about saving souls because full meaning in life is not simply found in politics. So I would want to emphasize this particular point here is that if the black church has one problem that I think it needs to think about, it is the problem of whether it is called to save its own life or whether it's called to lose its life for the sake of others. I feel that the black church is concerned with saving its own life because it's so interested in the gospel of success. the gospel of Jesus is not a gospel of success.
Talk, Jane.
The gospel of Jesus is a gospel of ultimate success through failure. It's a gospel of ultimate success through obvious failure. That's why the cross is at the center of the gospel. The cross is not a gospel of success. Jesus did not succeed. He failed. But God took that failure and transformed that failure into success. Now, it's very important when you talk about ultimate success, it's not so obvious, because the resurrection was not obvious. The tomb was empty, but yet nothing was there. I feel today with so much focus on building buildings and all the other humongous things that we do, that we fail to see that the cross is at the heart of what the black church ought to be about. It was not very difficult for the black church to see that during the time in which it was born. Because being a slave church, that was not success. That it was obvious failure there. Now, the problem is that the church has lost its legacy. It has lost its message. And when success becomes the focus of it, it loses its mission and it loses its message. I would like to see the church not be so concerned about its success, but much more concerned about a kind of success through failure, and where its failure is at the heart of things. So I would want to put my emphasis there. I'm concerned that the church doesn't get too concerned about its own survival. Because Jesus said, people who seek to save their life shall lose it. But if you lose your life for the sake of the least of these, then you'll find your life.
All right. Y'all don't want none of this.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Racism and Religion, an American Dilemma. That's our discussion for tonight. Brother Pugh, you want to talk about the unholy ghost that the book, or did you want to add some other points to that?
Okay, I can summarize the unholy ghost. Before I do that, let me just amplify, or as Malcolm X would say, let me just make plain something that Dr. Cone just said.
Okay,
when he talked about the fundamental purpose of the church is saving souls, you know, one of the things that enlightened thinkers recognize is that God is in you. right?
Yes.
And so if we understand that God is in you, and then we start thinking about what does saving souls mean,
mm-hmm.
well, saving souls means recognizing that God is in you, and that means recognizing that you've got two sources of leadership. One source can come from outside of you, coming through your mind, and the other source can come from inside of you, coming through your heart. And to save your soul means to be able to turn to your heart. And let me give you a concrete example of where that happened, where I believe when Martin Luther King's soul was saved.
Okay.
I believe there was a story that he said when his house was bombed, and he's in the middle of his house at 12 o'clock at night, and, you know, he had talked all that talk and whatnot. And I wasn't prepared to say this, so I can't recall exactly what he said, but it was the whole idea of him recognizing that he had to go deep inside himself and get something that will enable him to keep on going on. Because, I mean, it was some real stuff going on in his world.
Yeah.
That's what you're able to do when your soul is saved. But when you're a zombie, when you're the living dead, when you're a professional, when you're somebody that's operating from ideas in your head, well, you don't have access to that resource. And it turns out that everything in the universe is already inside of you. And so if your soul is saved, then that means that you can dig deep and get that. That's why people talk about put your back into it and all that. They're saying there's something in you that you can bring out, but you gotta have access to it. Let me just summarize Joe Edward Goza, G-O-Z-A. His book was entitled America's Unholy Ghost. And his book really kind of contradicts Kende's book, because Kende says that, you know, explicitly, he says that, look, you know, this whole notion, you know, I forget the sociologist, but there's a theory called context theory that was famous in 1954, the whole ideal of Brown versus Board. Says that, you know, racism can be solved if people get education and then they're around each other and they stop disliking each other. In other words, it was racism as a personal thing. Kende talks about racism as ultimately a structural thing, and therefore education and love won't solve it. And so Goza's thesis, this idea that he thinks he's taking Martin Luther King when Martin Luther King says that we need to study what the sources of racism are. But what Goza thinks is that what that means then is that, you know, we need to, you know, use that to, you know, to sort of enlighten people and to give them some love. But let me give it his thesis. What he says is that, you know, there are three thinkers during the Enlightenment period, or at least, the Enlightenment period from, you say, 1600 to Adam Smith was writing in 1776, and Hobbes was writing in, say, around 1616 in that region. Well, he says that, you know, one of the things that was happening was that, King Charles, who had been executed by the English, and they had a glorious revolution, and Hobbes was actually working for, the exiled king who had to leave England and run to France so that he wouldn't be executed too. And so what Hobbes was attempting to do was offer to the English people an alternative to what the English people were coming up with, some kind of way they can rule themselves without a king. They had already killed their king. Hobbes was interested in saying, no, you can't rule anything without, you know, you have to have a source of power. He called it a Leviathan. You got to have, you know, some big source of strength. And so that's the first thing that Goza says. He says that that this whole ideal of racism was one imagined by Hobbes, because he talked about human beings are, you know, beasts and whatnot, but they can be rational. But to be rational, that means that, you know, they need a source of rationality. And so So you can say that the source of irrationality comes from African people, and the source of rationality would say come from the king or whatnot. So what Hobbes was doing basically was apologizing for why it is that the English people really do need a king, but he called it a Leviathan. Now, the second guy was John Locke. And what Goza says about Locke is that, well, the problem with Hobbes was that the English people were not going to buy being subject to a king. But the problem that they had is they had this war of roses, you know, the 30-year war and whatnot, where the Protestants were killing Catholics and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And so one of the things that John Locke invented was liberalism, the whole ideal of tolerance. And in this case, they were talking about religious tolerance. That is to say, these people of these different religions, they can get together without having to kill each other. Well, in the past, what would happen is that a society, you were talking about the Catholic Church before, in the past, your society was actually run, by your church, everything you did from morning to night. And so what Locke was basically introducing when he talked about tolerance is he was introducing a third force independent of the church. And then that's where the third thinker comes in, the thinker Adam Smith. And one of the issues that you had then is that obviously if you're no longer going to be getting your instructions from the church, now well, what then is your source of instruction? And Adam Smith talked about capitalism, the invisible hand. That is to say that if you did, you know, what was in your best interest and I did what was in my best interest, well, that will actually redound to the best interest of everybody. And so so what that basically says is that you really don't even need the church for morality because the morality is just in you and your interest. And so that's what Goza is saying. Right. He's saying that that's the basis for for the unholy alliances. Now here's what he says. He says, well, now, how is it that, slavery could turn to segregation and segregation could come to mass incarceration? And he says, well, the reason that no matter what is done, that there's always some residual form, indeed increasing form of black oppression. Why is that going on? And he says, well, the reason is that in order to make those three transformations I just mentioned, the transformation of Hobbes, the transformation of Locke, and the transformation of Smith, you had to make some assumptions about the nature of the world. And let me see what he put. Do I have it here? Blah, blah, blah. He says that you had to tell some religious lies and you had to tell some political lies. And so I'll just summarize it like this and say that I was listening. There's a woman, she's a feminist ethical theorist at University of Michigan. Her name is Elizabeth Alexander. And I was reading an essay that she did in 1990. And she was talking about, all of these philanthropies, that they have. And by the way, the Federal Reserve just did a study, just came out about a month ago, that said that over the last 40 years, all despite, productivity and innovation and all that, all the economic returns have been such that the bottom 50% of the people in America, their net worth is less than it was in 1980, and all the returns went to the top 10%. But this woman, Anderson, when she was looking at philanthropists, she noticed that, James Cone talked about the body he talked about the body and the soul, right? So he said it's got to be political and it's got to be spiritual. Those got to be together, right? Well, Elizabeth Anderson, one of the things she pointed out is she said, hold it. What kind of morality or philanthropy do these? She said in the past when people talked about doing good and whatnot, it was all about helping people. It was all about looking at the social conditions that human societies have created and doing things to ameliorate those conditions.
Right.
But she noticed that these new moral systems that they were coming up with, they were like the equivalent of prosperity gospels in the sense that instead of focusing on doing things to repair a people, they were doing things to, say, repair a cleft lip or, in other words,
they were basically, you know, trying to repair natural things as opposed to trying to repair social things. But anyway, let me let you get a lick here.
Good. That's excellent. That's it. And for our listening audience, you know, we're talking about racism and religion. And what Mr. Pugh just presented is that ideology that continues to flow into the American ideological platforms and how things were taken up at the beginning. See, the key that we need to understand is these ideologies, in a lot of times, will become public policy for governing and ruling our lives. And so a lot of times a piece of legislation may be passed or may be proposed by somebody, and it's being proposed, backed up by this these lies and all of this development that we're talking about and these books and theories that are coming forward. And I'll give you one case in point that very clearly supports that. When they were trying to determine how to work with black families back in the 60s, and they asked some people, intellectuals, to do a study of the black family. And a senator out of New York named Daniel Patrick Monahan wrote an ugly, scathing piece about black families and black women. And as a result of that legislation or that discussion, they created a legislation called Aid to Families of Dependent Children, AFDC welfare. And as we know, that was the most destructive system and piece of legislation that could have ever happened. And our black communities are still not recuperated from that ideology. And then one last one, and then I'm going to open up the lines and let some of our other listeners come in, and then I'm going to come back to Mr. Pugh because he has another book I want him to talk about. But the other one was the bell curve. The bell curve was an attempt to try to end AFDC and put into place a new system that became known as W-2, welfare to work. And that ugly system was established based on some ugly racist scientific theories that have never been proven to be correct. But it didn't matter. Power and money backed it up. An organization out of Wisconsin, which is has a lot of influence by the John Birch Society, called the Bradley Foundation, funded that book called The Bell Curve. And they gave it to the legislatures or the Wisconsin legislature, and they passed the W-2 bill. It also was responsible for putting in place choice schools, which was an attempt to segregate public education again and to send blacks to their own school and whites to their own school, and all of that. Those are the kinds of things that are done with this history. These think tanks that we know about, these foundations that do these studies, and then they end up giving them to legislatures who write laws and pass them. And they didn't become to govern your life. You can't do anything about it. It's all there, you know. And a lot of times, unfortunately, our politicians are not astute enough to catch it and to try to fight. Some do, but some don't, and they participate in it because of the game of politics. So that's why we're doing this. That's why I wanted Mr. Pugh to talk about that. Adam Smith, as you know, was the theorist that put into place what we know as American capitalism and how that system would work and the source of money and banks and interest and all of that. That's Adam Smith. And they would follow him. And Adam Smith said that there was nothing that Africa could do for anybody in the world. And I don't know how he could say that with all those resources, but he said that they don't know how to run their resources. And that's why you need to go over there and take them, because they don't know what to do with them. And they did that. That's exactly what they did. That was the whole partitioning of Africa in the Berlin Conference. And the justification for doing the Berlin Conference was that the Africans don't know what they're doing and they're not able to use it. So let's go over and use it, and we can justify it, you know, through some of the what they claim to have been their inferiority. Okay, Brother Marcus, how you doing today? Want to add anything to this conversation?
Yes, Dr. Rogers. Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening to you.
You know, it's good you're doing this series on religion, because that is the paralyzer of our people. That's what paralyzing our people mentally, you know.
Right.
That foolishness they come with, because there is no historical evidence of a person named Jesus walking the planet. No historical evidence. There may be theological, you know, evidence, but as we know, theology, you know, I mean, look, God is a human construct. The concept of God came out of the minds of men. See, you know, God didn't create men. Men created God. And these Europeans, the first thing they came to Africa with was with their religion. They come, oh, let your God be my God, and my God be your God. Next thing you know, we in chains. Coming over on the first ship, the slave ship, the good ship Jesus.
Yeah.
That was the name of the first slave ship. And if you listen to those old spirituals that black people used to sing that song, steal away. Steal away to Jesus. That's what they were saying. They wanted to get back on the ship that brought us here.
Right.
So religion always have devastated black people. In the, you know, any form of religion, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, always put black people at the bottom. So I don't subscribe to nothing. If anything, I believe in the old-time religion, like Nocturnal religion. That is my bishop right there, Bishop Nocturnal. You see what I'm saying? So look, it's foolishness. It's all divine adjudication is a fallacy for black people. They tell us, oh, you know, give us an image of a white man. Say, that is your savior. That's your Lord and Savior right there. We go to church Sunday and kneel down and pray. They give our money to the church. That take the money and take it to a white bank that use the money to gentrify our community. You know what I'm saying? So
right,
the church is not working in our interest. These pimp preachers, they don't care nothing about liberation for black people. Very, very few. You know, you have to use a microscope to find them. So, you know, I believe in what Mao Zedong said. When Mao Zedong came to power, he put all the preachers, the imams, the bishop, he said, you know what I'm going to do with you? I'm going to put you in the dungeon. And when God come, he's going to sign your release. And that's where our religion, our revolution got to go. Put them in the damn dungeon. And when God come, God will sign the release. Thank you, good brother.
Okay, thank you, Brother Marcus. Always enjoyable to hear you. I've got a sister that from North Bethesda, Maryland. I don't know if you were just listening or you want to add any comments. If so, the mic is open for you. If not, I'll close it back. Okay, so maybe you're just listening. Thank you so much for joining us. We definitely hope you will join us again. Brother Griffin, what about you? You add anything to this conversation?
No, I did invite that sister from Bethesda to listen in, though, because I always enjoy your program.
Thank you.
Dr. Pugh, I appreciate that you finally got a chance to lay it out without getting chopped up and cut across. Appreciate that.
Right. Thank you. Okay. My brother, Brother Timothy, how you doing, my brother?
I'm going to Mr. Pugh is honorary doctor tonight. he laid it down. And Dr. Rogers, with you co-hosting, I mean, you opened it up. What you did, what most people cannot do, you explained Yaku and the Aegean Sea.
That's right.
And I never heard nobody break it down like that. That's what Elijah Muhammad was trying to tell the people in such simple terms and language. And if he would have told you in a complicated way, he would have ran away from it.
Okay.
I'm going to say this, Dr. Rogers and Dr. Pugh. my neighborhood still has a bank that Daddy Grace built that I can walk to from my house. And I wish you could still see the structure. It was built in the 50s. It's still immaculate.
All right.
And not some years back, Kenny Gamble and myself used to go to Father Devine's place. They stopped serving food there, I guess about maybe 12 to 14 years ago. And, you know, Mother Lorraine, she's dead. And in the place of the dining hall, it's this I mean, they have a phone booth in there, like, from the 1950s. It's so clean. It doesn't look like nobody sat in it. But I'm going to keep moving this way. That when I think about Black God of the Metropolis, and it talks about Elijah Muhammad and Daddy Grace, I never knew he was from the Cape Verde Islands. And listen to me. And so was Amilcar Cabral. And I didn't know that he was, but I learned something from this whole situation, that when Elijah Muhammad was explaining his movement, they referred to him as a racist. No, I think he was exposing racism. And when you talk about Daddy Grace, you talked about Father Devine. I know this guy by the name of Charles Lance Taylor. He's supposed to be working on the book.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about Devine. And he said, Tim, they had nothing on the man. He said, Tim, don't you know, especially marrying his second wife, but the white woman, I believe. He said, if they could have gotten him, they would have been, they had nothing on. Those men, like you said, knew what they knew about God, and they gave back to the community. They didn't pimp anything. They did more for people in their community. Food, soup kitchen, clothing,
right,
haircuts.
Right.
I go on and on. That's all I can tell you. And you two people did a very good job of breaking down what they did, how they were, and how nobody can mimic it today. They were the total embodiment of their movement. Because once Elijah Muhammad left us, wasn't the same. Daddy Grace gone, wasn't the same.
Right.
Father Divine gone, wasn't the same.
That's right.
Can't bring them back. But how do we use the blueprint to do their work? I don't think it can be mimicked.
That's right. Very good. Thank you, Brother Timothy. Always stay with us. We're gonna continue. I want to go back to Brother Pugh a minute, ask him to talk about the other book. But before I do, I just want to mention something that's necessary in understanding how all of this has begun to permeate into the religious ideology, and as a result has been used to terrorize black people. You got to remember, when they were terrorizing us in the South in the Jim Crow years, they were burning crosses. So if we are keeping our focus on the cross, they will burn them. That's a psychological system of trying to terrorize you to the maximum point. That was a theory that was used at the time by the Euro-theologians of their era. It was called the whole idea of looking at creation. They even went back that far, that looking at creation and understanding who is in the Adamic family. And obviously, as I indicated, you know, Adam is obviously white. Jesus is white, according to the Euro world. So if you don't look like Jesus, or you didn't look like Adam, then you must not be a part of the Adamic family. And this was taught in seminaries, the seminaries of the country that were training preachers and preparing them for ministry, were taught that. And the evidence of that is that there was a man by the name of John Carroll, who was the head of a seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. And he wrote a book called The Negro, a Beast. And what he said in that book was that the Negro could not have been a part of the Adamic family because Adam looked like this white, Eve looked like this, and the only other thing in the Garden of Eden on the morning of creation was a snake. And that snake must have been the Negro. And so he wrote that in that book, and he published it for his students. And he was the head of this seminary in St. Louis. As you know, St. Louis is right near some of that horrible history that we recently had in Missouri. So you can see where the indoctrination of a lot of that. And those churches preach that. They find ways to preach these ideologies. So the whole concept of monogenetics, for instance, does not hold up in the racist ideology that we see, because monogenetics would say that we all came from one source of creation. And the opposite theory is that we were created from different sources. And so somebody had to come from the snake. And so that whole history of the Garden of Eden is embedded into the ideology of a lot of the churches, and particularly the Christian churches of the South, that are the ones that are promoting the terrorism and so forth. So that's important. That's important that we understand that history, because they argue that. They argue that in biology, is argued throughout that. They say that obviously the Negro comes from the gorilla. He is an offshoot of the ape. That's Christian ideology that's saying that. That's not just strict biology, because who did we indicate were the universities of America? Where they come from? Well, they came from that. Yale University was at the helm of that. Columbia, out of New York, was at the helm of looking at the monogenetic theories. And some of the great, what they think were the great European writers were looking at it, and they saying that the African was inferior. And Zora Neale Hurston, as a matter of fact, studied under one of the Columbia University professors by the name of Franz Boas, who did not agree that the African was inferior. He just says that he was inferior from conditioning under society, not biologically. And so that's the fight that will take us into the 20th century. Is the African biologically inferior, or is he inferior from conditioning? And a lot of universities would create studies and things like that. And then it would not be until the African studies organizations began to grow and develop that some of that would be challenged. But nevertheless, it depended on a lot, because obviously the universities are the ones that have to fund them. Okay, so Mr. Pugh, what is that other book that we want to talk about real quickly that also embraces the whole idea of racism and religion, The American Dilemma? What is that book that you was mentioning?
Let's see, Racism and Religion? Talking about Racecraft Barbara Fields and Karen Fields.
Right, that's the one.
Where she compares race to witchcraft. But can I take a second and sort of speak to what Tim said, what Brother Marcus said, and what you said? In other words, I think I can connect all them dots, man.
Okay, but I want you to definitely talk about that book, because it's like we're going to have about 10 minutes when you start. But go right ahead.
Oh, I can do it quickly. Iyanna Pressley, you know, one of the members of the squad, talked about black faces that don't want to have a black voice. Well, when Brother Tim says, you know, how can we save it? And theologian James Cone talked about saving souls. Well, it's really just what Iyanna Pressley was saying. She's talking about having a black voice. That means coming from your heart. So all you got to do is show people to come from their heart. In fact, young people, they've been saying it now for the last 20 years. They talk about keep it real, about representing. That's what they're talking about. So when you talked about AFDC and when you talked about W-2 and you remember urban renewal and all of these kind of programs, well, Well, you remember there was an expression that says, you're not at the table. If you're not at the table, you the meal.
Right.
But if you're at the table and you're somebody that, you know, has a black face but don't have a black voice, that is to say, your soul hasn't been saved, well, then what will happen is that you will unwittingly participate in the urban renewal of your community, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the process. So what Dr. Fields, Barbara Fields and Karen Fields are talking about in racecraft is she's saying that these things are constructed. In other words, it's understood that if you have a goal to, for example, use me, as a tennis player, then what you're going to do is you're going to get all the evidence you can in the world about why I should be a tennis player and present it to me as if it's reality.
Right.
That's what it is. And so let me take – and so that's what you're doing with racecraft, is that you're basically crafting a thing you want to be in the world. That's what we said, that spiritual things all begin with the process.
Right.
In the beginning was the word. So in this case, I need a race. I need an inferior people that I can do some things to. Well, who's suitable for that? And it turns out that, you know, the first people that they did it to in America were the indentured servants. But when the indentured servants, after they had, you know, served their indenture and whatnot, they all of a sudden started wanting, you know, to actually get the same rights, that the people with wealth had. And so they said, oh, okay, this indenture ain't working. We need something stronger than that. And race had the advantage that, well, this is an indenture. You in this forever. But by the way, in terms of spirituality, let me just mention some other things that are just as spiritual as religion, so that you realize that when you're talking about that word, that you don't we're not necessarily just talking about Jesus. Whenever you talk about God, obviously that's spiritual. In other words, anything that's an idea of, in fact, you know, they are lawmakers and they're law takers. And so spirituality is the creation of the law. So let me just give some examples of some law. I just had it written down there. I know money is a law. In other words, money is a thing that doesn't exist in the world, but by agreement, people use it, you know, to do some things.
Right.
Nation is a law. That's a thing that doesn't exist in the world, but people can agree. Race is not a thing, but that, you know, Du Bois talk about race is people who got to ride Jim Crow in Georgia, because obviously Homer Plessy, he was as white as a white man, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So it wasn't what he looked like phenotypically. It was rather what sociologically they wanted to assign him to. But let me see if I think I had another example. In other words, so what I'm trying to do is demystify the concept of religion and demystify the concept of race and use Kendi's thesis that hold it. These are tools that people are using to advance their agenda.
Yes,
now, when
correct.
It comes to the deconstruction, there are two people. You don't worry about deconstructing lawmakers because they already know it's a fraud. They're not interested in the truth. They're interested in things that are going to advance their agenda.
Right.
On the other hand, law takers, whether you're a black person who's been bamboozled and had your head filled with you know, these bogus notions from somebody else's heart, or you're a white person who's been bamboozled. Well, now that's a different story. So when it comes to these lawmakers, that is to say, these people who look at the world the way it is today and think this is the best of all possible worlds, and they're talking about they want to go to Mars and all this kind of nonsense, you know that these people are not going to be amenable to education and love.
Right.
On the other hand, when you find these people operating, talking about what they can't do and gave up hope and all that, well, now all of a sudden, now you got some people who need their souls saved.
Okay.
Or another, a third group of people. These are people who they are woke, but they ain't all the way woke.
Okay.
And so you can help wake them up.
Okay.
So, but
you got about 5 minutes.
Let somebody else get a lick in.
Okay, that's good. Great. I like that. All right, tell us real quickly about that book. You got 5 minutes.
Now, which one? About the Fields?
Craft and the one you talked about.
Right,
today.
Right. Well, racecraft, right. So what she was saying was that in the same way that, you know, race has the same function that witchcraft has. And she shows that, you know, you can go to Africa and you can go to India, any place where witchcraft goes on. This is used to essentially take property from people. In other words, if you're somebody and the men in your family have been killed, but you got some property, then somebody is going to call you a witch. And one of the things that you get to do when you call somebody a witch, you get to take their stuff. And the way that they can prove they're not a witch is that you have to cut them open and see if their entrails look a certain way. And of course, it's too late. I mean, you know, if you find out they're not a witch, well, it's too late now. So, you know.
Right, exactly.
You know, I thought you were.
And what is the name of that book again?
Excuse me?
Tell us the name of that book.
The title of the book is Racecraft. Let me see. Did I have it right here? Racecraft. Karen and Barbara Fields.
Right, exactly.
Are the authors.
Okay, all right. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have, as I said, this is our prologue session for our discussion on the Black Church and the whole idea of religion. Hopefully we've been able to paint some resources that you can go and take a look at and see how all of this works. We're not talking history. As John Henry Clark says, all of history is a current event. And this is this stuff is still current with us today, and it has been with us for a while, and we have to understand it. And I like what Mr. Pugh says. You know, you can't. There's a lot of things we can do, and there's a lot of things you're not going to be able to do. And so, what we have to do is look at what's best interest for African people. And one of the things that we have to do is the preparation for our children. I think about that quote from Dr. John Henry Clark. He says, we should produce a caliber of young people who can take on the loneliness of struggle. We should produce a caliber of young people who can take on the loneliness of struggle. And what he's speaking of is obviously a lot of times in struggle, you won't get support like you want to. And so it'll be a lonely battle. You will be like Don Quixote trying to fight the windmill or you know, and however, but very clearly you have to fight, and we have to create some young people who are willing to get out there and do that regardless of who's with them or what the circumstances is. Religion is critical. As I said, we are African people, spiritual people, and it's very important to us in terms of how we view that and how we use that in our day-to-day lives. And so I think as we move on, I highly recommend that you research a lot of this history, look at it. Next week, we're going to continue our conversation on the Black Church, and hopefully our co-host is going to be able to join us, Sister Ayan, and we're going to talk with some clergy, and we get a chance to ask them some things, and hopefully hard questions. We don't want just easy putting questions. We want hard questions that can help us grow. And obviously the only way to do that is you have to challenge the traditional standing of the way things are. Have a wonderful week, productive week, and we will see you on next Tuesday at 8 o'clock here at the Black Reality Think Tank.
Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is me, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is us, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is free, black is me, black is us, black is free. Black is you, black is me.